Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Buenos dias, muchas enchiladas. Welcome, everybody, to the Patrick Madrid Show on a lovely Monday morning. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. As it happens, Nancy and I had an opportunity to visit a shrine. If you ever get a chance to get near Baltimore, check this out. It's the Shrine of St. Anthony in Ellicott City. You may say, where is Ellicott City? It's not even like a city. I don't even think there is any kind of a city there, but it's called Ellicott City. It's out in the rolling, lush, beautiful farmland of rural Maryland. It's not terribly far from Baltimore. Thank you. But absolutely beautiful. And I had the opportunity to speak to a large group of people who attended a one-day event that I did there, and we were lucky enough to be able to spend the weekend there. It was wonderful and prayerful, and really enjoyed it. So a shout-out to all of our friends and Relevant Radio listeners and Patrick Madrid Show listeners who attended the event this past weekend at the Shrine of St. Anthony. And I really mean it. If you ever get a chance to go out toward D.C., toward Baltimore, see if you can't, you know, have a little digression and go there and enjoy it. I think you'll thank, believe me now and thank me later. Also, on the way home, Cyrus, you're kind of a Civil War buff, aren't you? You like the Civil War history stuff, don't you?
That's the other Cyrus.
Oh, that's the other Cyrus.
Yeah,
I like that Cyrus better in this area because I am a super Civil War buff. I love it to the nth degree. You're not that like that?
I am not, no.
Oh,
nope.
Man.
No, I don't like the war stuff. I stay away from it. Yeah. I know.
So like battlefields and...
Nope.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry. I can't play along.
This changes everything.
I know. You want me to be all excited. Well, I'm excited for you. I'm happy that you like it.
You're happy for me?
I am.
Okay.
I'm glad that you can nerd out. You can nerd out
on
that stuff.
So I know this may not sound like much fun to you, but on the way back from Baltimore, we had to cross over Antietam Creek. And you may say, that sounds familiar.
That sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm. The Battle of Antietam in 1862, September to be exact, 1862. It was the bloodiest day of battle, more so than D-Day, more so than Gettysburg, more so than any other battle. And it's just a magnificently beautiful battlefield, completely preserved, which is one of the wonders, you know, of our history, that some people have the presence of mind to maintain and to set aside these lands where these battles were fought. And just a spectacular battlefield. We didn't have a chance to spend much time there. We spent maybe an hour and a half or so, drove around, looked at the various scenes. So that too, I realize this may not apply to you, young Cyrus, but for those of you out there, for those of you normal people, who like history, the Civil War history especially. Oh, Cyrus, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you. That was good, clean fun right there. Cyrus, he won't even make eye contact with me now. Look at that. if you get a chance, go visit it. The Antietam Battlefield. It's about 10 miles north of I-70. And it's just magnificent. 888-914-9149. Now, I do have a question I want to ask you, Cyrus. Do you ever order like food to be delivered to your home from Grubhub or DoorDash or any of the other companies that specialize in such things? Do you ever do that?
Other than pizza? No.
You could include pizza.
All right, then yes.
Okay. Pizza might be a little harder to disguise. You'll understand what I'm driving at here. Study Finds has an article that everybody should read if you can handle it. If you order takeout, be aware that a new survey has found that 8 in 10 food delivery workers admit to eating part of your order.
Come on,
before,
man.
Before it gets to you.
No way.
Before it gets.
No, 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 no.
Maybe they're just picking the pepperonis off the top of your pizza.
I didn't order a cheese pizza. What's going on?
Yeah, here? I ordered pepperoni. And you could see the faint imprints of where the pepperonis used to be. So check it out. there was a poll done of 500 delivery drivers. It was commissioned by Circuit Route Planner. And they asked the drivers about, like, do you ever eat the food before you bring it to the customer? One in four drivers says that they have, well, they get into a few other things. I won't even get into those things. But the main thing is that they admit 8 in 10 admit to eating some of the food before it gets
to you. So you're saying if it's like a burger and fries, some of those fries aren't going to make it. So that some, not only are they eating the food, they're touching it. I think that bothers me more.
All of it bothers me. Everything about this bothers me. So we'll get a link posted for people to take a look at. But there are a bunch of other things that I don't really want to go into on the radio that they admit to doing, which will make you even more hesitant.
Well, I'll tell you what, Patrick. I worked in the food service industry throughout college. And be nice to your waiter. Don't be mean to your waiter.
I don't disagree. In fact, I think you can learn a lot about somebody by observing how they treat waiters and other people like that. Well, here's part of the survey. They get into why do some delivery drivers not like you? And here's how that breaks down. You tip poorly, 73%. Your dogs bark at them, 57%. Your neighbors are rude, 35%. Why would they hold that against you? This was counterintuitive. You're overly friendly. 34% of couriers said that they don't like people who are overly friendly.
He smiled at me. I'm going to eat his fries.
Your home is difficult to get to, 34%. You're unfriendly, 30%. You live in a neighborhood that makes them feel unsafe, 17%. So some interesting tidbits here, but definitely check it out in terms of if you order food, you might not be getting all of it.
What the unsafe neighborhood was the lowest percent on all of those.
It was.
I don't know what they're going to do if they see me eating their fries. So I'm not going to eat their fries.
They're less worried about that than you being overly friendly. Isn't that interesting?
Weird. Hmm.
Interesting. Well, we'll get that posted, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Cindy, straight off the top in Los Angeles. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you so much for your show. I'm a regular listener, and I like listen to many different perspectives and like your perspective. So, the reason I was calling is I heard a caller call in, I think it was Friday, about the New American Bible, the St. Joseph edition.
Yeah.
And I know what he's referring to in the preface. It's a Vatican II document, which is on the Dogmatic Constitution for Divine Revelation, which specifically says that we are to consider literary forms. So, I just think if you dismiss the whole historical critical method, you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater, because it doesn't mean that people don't believe in the historicity of the miracle stories. Or I've never encountered anything like that in the New American Bible, and I was recommended to use that edition by two priests at my parish, who I had Bible study with for 7 years, and I never saw anything like that in there.
Well, I appreciate the anecdotal information, Cindy. I do. I'm wondering I don't know if you heard the entire conversation, but I absolutely don't dismiss the historical critical method entirely. There are problematic aspects of it. Furthermore, absolutely, the popes have emphasized repeatedly that there are different literary forms of scripture. So that's front and center in terms of Catholic teaching. I'm not sure where you picked up on the idea that I reject that view. I certainly don't.
And I don't, I think there are different perspectives, and I also really like Brent Pitra, and I have his Old Testament commentary. Mm-hmm. But I think it's good to, if somebody is serious about understanding Bible scholarship, and I've only had one semester of biblical theology, so I'm not an expert, but, that it's good to listen to a variety of perspectives. I've also done the Bible timeline, and I think they're all wonderful. You might have known about the Pontifical Biblical Commission publication on the interpretation of the Bible. Yeah, in church. It does discuss the historical critical method. And that's available.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Cody. Or Cindy, excuse me. Go ahead.
And that is available on the internet on PDF. So if people really want to see what the church has to say about it, they can access that.
I hope this is of some encouragement to you, Cindy, but I wrote my master's thesis, about 200 pages, on the document you're referring to, Dei Verbum, and incorporated.
Really? Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was the subject of my master's thesis. It was not the historical critical method per se, but modes of interpreting scripture as it relates to tradition And it was looking at it from a Catholic Protestant perspective. So mm-hmm. if it's of any encouragement to you, I'm deeply familiar with these resources that you're referring to. My concern with some of the notes in the New American Bible are that they, as I said earlier, they promote a hermeneutic of suspicion and demystification in the sense that they cut against the grain of what the church has traditionally taught on certain things, like the authorship of the Gospel of St. Matthew. The notes say St. Matthew didn't write that. The church has always said that St. Matthew did write that. So that's an example of where there are some problems. And I'm happy to hear that you're open-minded. I think I am too. So I really appreciate you bringing this up so we can talk about it a little bit more.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your insight. And I always love the show. So thank you for
listening
to me on the air.
Thank you. Always. Look forward to talking to you again. 888-914-9149. Let's go now. Where are we going? Let's go to Austin and talk to Linda. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Patrick. I've got a quick question for you. I listened to you talk to a prisoner on the phone last week. Anyway, the one that was...
No, he was set free 402 days.
Yes.
Yeah, and he was innocent.
I couldn't believe it.
That's amazing.
I know. It's horrifying. But, yeah, he seemed to have a good attitude. But anyway, I'm asking you, do you have any inspirational Catholic books that I could send to a nephew who is incarcerated in El Paso, Texas? He has not been baptized. He was raised severely abused by both fathers. He had a... biological father who left him, was a rocker, you know, a rock star, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he left him at 1 or 2 years old. And then he has an adopted father who is was severely abusive with him.
Yeah.
And he was punished. One of the ways he was punished was that he had to read the Bible. And reading it, if he didn't report it exactly how the dad wanted, he was punished severely. And, I mean, the abuse was horrific. So he's open. He's going to the whatever they have at the prison there to a religious, you know, maybe it's evangelical. I'm not sure. He knows I'm Catholic. So, you know, I've sent him the book Fearless.
So you're looking for some good book recommendations?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm not cutting to the chase. Yeah,
He's, don't be sorry. I just wanted to make sure I was understanding what you were asking me.
Yes, I need because he's passing these books around to several of the other inmates. I gave him Fearless. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but
I'm not.
It's inspirational. No. It's Catholic. So it's, but he loved it, and he just said, "I'm open, Aunt Linda. I'm trying very hard, but you have to understand." He shared it with me what happened to him.
Well, here's what I'd suggest, Linda. First of all, I will recommend a few books for you. I would recommend a book by Dr. Peter Kraft called Making Sense Out of Suffering, because it's the big picture view. He's in a place where there's a lot of suffering. So this takes up that question, and how do we find meaning in suffering? Is there any redemption or purification in suffering? And how do we cope with suffering? I have a feeling that'll really scratch an itch for him, as it would for anybody. Another book that I like to refer people to in situations like this is called Arise from Darkness, What to Do When Life Doesn't Make Sense. And I would think that if you're stuck behind bars, life doesn't make much sense because your life has been put on hold in a certain way.
Oh.
So that's by Father Benedict Groeschel, Groeschel.
Okay.
Arise from Darkness. Now, I'm hearing more and more, Linda, and when I was out in Bakersfield a couple of weeks ago doing an event there, I was talking to some of the people in the audience who were correctional officers at prisons. And I'm finding out something I didn't really know much about before, and that is how prevalent it is for inmates to be able to listen to the radio, and they can even have radios in some cases. So if it's possible for your nephew to be able to listen to relevant radio, if you can send him a little radio, or if you could pay for a radio. I think in some cases the inmates have to buy them, so perhaps a family member could buy the radio for him. In which case, if that's possible, you could really help him a lot because he can 24/7 listen to relevant radio and all this programming is there for him. And I have a feeling that would greatly assist him too, because it's going to fill in a lot of the gaps and maybe address some of the very issues that he's thinking about or wondering about. That's
excellent.
Another suggestion.
May I ask you, where do you know the station in El Paso? Do you know?
No, I don't, but here's how you can find out quickly. And anybody listening, wherever you are in the country, here's how you can find out if we have a station near you. And chances are we do, because we have 200 stations around the country, including our beloved affiliate stations. Shout out to all the affiliate stations. So just go to relevantradio.com, Linda, and there, I'm going to do it right now so I can guide you exactly where you need to go. Go to relevantradio.com, and then you'll see where it says listen in the navigation bar, and just click on stations. And then that'll show you all of our stations, the ones that are owned and operated by Relevant Radio, as well as the ones that are affiliates and they carry Relevant Radio programming. And that's all there geographically. You can zoom in and look at the map and find out what's there near you, or near him, rather. Okay.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you.
You're welcome, Linda. Great talking to you. I think this would be a perfect time to take a break, don't you? Why don't we do that? You can refill your cup of coffee, and we will get right back to it on the other side of this timeout. 888-914-9149. I'm also going to share with you a very interesting, and I think insightful commentary about how you eat food. Says some really important, deep things about you and the kind of person you are. And you're saying, what? Well, you don't want to miss this. I'll share that with you on the other side of this quick timeout. Please stay right there. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I love that so much. Welcome back, 888-914. You're just bracing and building and waiting and then nothing.
I love how much love you love it.
I love it so much. Can I hear that one more time, please?
You're just beaming.
It gives me such joy.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
It's so perfect. It's just because it's the absolute lack of fulfillment. You get zero. You get nothing.
Good day, sir.
Okay. Let me try to collect myself. Okay. So as a promise, we're going to get to the phone calls in a minute. Dr. John Cutterback, he is a professor at Christendom College, and he has a fascinating article on how you eat can tell you a lot about who you are and how you are. And so he starts with a quote from an author named Leon Cass, who says, "We can ask whether and to what extent our customs about eating are informed by insights into our nature. We can even ask whether and to what extent our customs about eating contribute to the perfection of our nature." Now, that may sound a bit dry to you, but let me break it down. And I'm going to read to you some excerpts from this article by John Cutterback. He talks about how at the conclusion of a study on human nature in one of the classes he taught, one of his young women students came up to him and said, "I want to live according to the truth we have studied. What do you suggest I do?" That's a very insightful question from a student. And he says the following. He says, start by asking God. He has put this question into your heart. He will provide an answer if you ask. Second, look at how you eat. Look at how you'd never imagine that could tell you something, could it? In how you eat, you embody and cultivate your deepest convictions about what it is to be human. Being intentional about how you eat, examining and making fitting resolutions, this is an obvious concrete path to living the truth more fully, and human life is always essentially about living the truth. In view of this, he says, here are three questions you should ask yourself about how you eat. And for parents and any in authority over a community that eats together, this immediately takes on great significance given our solemn responsibility to oversee and form how our family or our community eats every day. Yet no less is it the challenge of the household of one, in other words, if you're living alone, for example, to make eating a veritable daily enactment of who you are and who you want to be. So here are the three questions he proposes that you ask yourself. Number one, does what you eat reflect basic truths of human nature and human difference? Eating is a moral act. As in any moral act, the object is significant, and the first object in eating is the very thing you're eating. Some things are fit to be eaten, others are not. What should you eat, and what should you not eat? There are many facets to this issue. He says, he suggests that you will have much to be grateful for in the abundance of food that's available to you. You also must realize that what is presented to you for consumption is largely the product of a food industry in which the principles of production often do not include a moral compass. In other words, at least sometimes you might be sold, quote-unquote, something that is not fit for you to eat. For instance, animals and even plants can be grown in ways that do not respect the natural order. Further, food should nourish your body, not simply tickle your taste buds while undermining, often subtly, your bodily health. These are real issues, some aspects of which can be beyond your control, but their complexity does not absolve you from doing what you reasonably can do to eat good things. He says, the next two questions concern how you eat. So the second question is, of the three, do your manners in eating express and cultivate virtue? And he quotes Cass again, who says, moreover, the principles of self-command and consideration for others shown in small manners are a piece of with virtue and justice. Indeed, civility may very well be the heart of the ethics of everyday life. So he points out, manners are perhaps the primary avenue in which you begin to direct and form children, and the epicenter of daily manners is mealtime. From their earliest days, children at table begin to learn and enact basic virtuous dispositions, respect, justice, generosity, and temperance. This is not to mention how manners likewise cultivate other human goods, such as higher culture and friendship. This is true for adults. Virtues are formed, honed, and perfected by practice. Mealtimes are an obvious, consistent context for such daily practice. Here is where the rubber meets the road, where all of us, again, even those who live alone, can discover in manners and etiquette the bodily expressions and thus practice the most profound interior dispositions. I'm going to intervene here for just a moment. I recall vividly growing up, my mother especially, more so my mother than my father, my dad was more the enforcer, but my mom would say, sit up straight. You're at the table, sit up straight. Because, you know, you shouldn't be slouching at the table. I never really understood why that was a big deal. I do now. Because as a kid, you're just sort of like there to consume. You're there to inhale your food. But I remember my mother trying to instill a certain sense of decorum at the dinner table. Sit up straight. Wash your hands. You know, don't chew with your mouth open. I'm sure that all of us remember at least some of those things. If you're going to be chewing food, keep your mouth closed so other people don't have to see it.
This is really interesting. My 11-year-old was sitting at the table with her knees like, it looked like she was ready to bolt out of there. So she's eating at the table. So she's doing all the right things, but she's not sitting proper. So her back's straight, but her knees are like, it looks like she's ready to run from the table the second she puts the fork down. And so I was like, hey, can you please put your knees under the table? And it turned into this thing. It's like, well, why does it matter? Why does it matter, Dad? Mm-hmm. And it ultimately was just, I said, because I told you to.
That's right.
So I wish I had. Because
I control your food intake.
Right.
Well, no, that's a good point. In other words, that gets to the issue of posture. In other words, you were picking up, I presume, that by her posture, she wasn't really present to you and the rest of the family. She was ready to bolt.
Right.
Yeah. That's a very insightful point. Did your mom ever tell you to sit up straight at the table when you were a kid?
I don't know. I don't recall. I would eat so fast. That was my problem. I'm a fast eater. So I don't think I was at the table for very long when I was at the table.
Yeah. Well, I can understand that. And different families have different ways, so I'm not here to judge anyone. I'm just kind of sharing my own experience. So I'm the oldest of eight, so I was always growing up with younger siblings at the table with me. And so another thing that comes to my mind as I'm thinking about this article by Dr. Cutterback is that when I was growing up, you know, now that I look back on it, I could see that my mom was trying to instill some etiquette and some manners. Another thing that was very common in our household would be if there was like one piece of chicken left or one piece of whatever left, that you could not just zoom in and take it. You had to ask, is it okay if I have this last piece of chicken? Because there was a sort of community interest, you know, in that last piece of food. And so you couldn't just be rude and grab it. That was something I learned when I was little. Another thing that was not at all uncommon was to ask for the food to be passed to you. And there were times when I could easily reach it. You know, I could just reach across the table and grab the bowl of whatever. And my mom would say, ask for it to be passed to you. And that too, like a little thing, it was irritating to me at the time because I didn't really give it any thought. But I learned to do it. And as I grew up and entered into more polite society, I realized that table etiquette is important. And you don't want to eat with somebody who is just a slob or just reaching across the table and doesn't show proper etiquette. It's a form of respecting others, if you ask me. So, all right, so let's continue.
Get those elbows off the table.
Yeah, and sit up straight. If I had a dollar, if I had a nickel, for every time my mom told me to sit up straight, and it was always in that tone of voice, sit up straight. It was never in any other tone of voice. And I knew that tone of voice, which meant that if I didn't, my dad was going to get involved. And I didn't want that. One time, Cyrus, I got to tell you this. True confessions. Are you ready?
Yeah, lay it on me.
Okay. I was at the kitchen table and I mouthed off to my mother.
Oh.
I said something. It was disrespectful. She said something to me and I came back with some sarcastic remark, and I was about 9 years of age. I did not even know what happened to me, but I'm telling you, my dad was sitting at the head of the table to my left and I was seated next to him to his right. My mother was at the other end of the table and then various siblings gathered around the table. I'm telling you, he backhanded me.
Whoa.
With his hand. He kept eating, but he just backhanded me on the side of the face, slapped my face, and my glass of milk went flying, hit the wall, milk everywhere. And I was so stunned by that. And he just said, never talk back to your mother like that. Yes, sir.
And then you went and cleaned up the milk.
Oh, yes. And I tell you what, I've never forgotten that. My dad was calm. He wasn't angry, but it was like a lightning strike just out of the blue. And it got my attention, and I never did that again. And I've never forgotten it. Talk about learning some etiquette at the table. You can learn the hard way, or you can learn the harder way. And I learned the harder way that day, but I learned. Okay, third question. Do your practices at the table cultivate real presence, especially through rich conversation? So referring to Cass again, he says, it is shared speech, even more than shared food, that makes a community of diners. So he says, is there anything you do in your home that is more expressive of how you share your life together with your family? At the table, you discover that you belong, that life is always shared life, that you are never alone. And you begin by listening, and that others have something to say, and that you too have something to say, and others will listen because they love you. He says he thinks the greatest gift and fruit of human eating is this interaction, this presence to each other. He says you can discover and prepare yourself for relating to other people in ways both extraordinary and ordinary. You discover that the ordinary can be extraordinary, and that human life is a kind of feast, a feast that is foreshadowed and rightly begun in eating at the table. And what you discover and practice at the table, though it changes in various ways throughout your life, will never really pass away, but rather pass over into something that includes all that richness and even more. I like that. And I think it's right on target. something that we do every single day, several times a day, in fact, and chances are don't give it a whole lot of thought. So if you find that interesting, or if you wanted to share that with your kids who might need a little bit of virtue training, you'll find that on the show Twitter feed, which is available at P Madrid Show on Twitter, or you can go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Lee now in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Pat. I'm a former corrections officer.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to let people know that some states and institutions require books to come in from a retailer. A private person cannot send them in.
Right.
They have to come in from a retailer like Amazon or Catholic bookstore or something like that, you know. So it's...
Yeah. I found that out the hard way, Lee, when I have sent books to prisoners and then they get returned for that very reason. So I learned that, and I'm glad you're bringing that up. That's an important point.
Yes. And that's all I wanted to say. I enjoy your show very much. I really do.
Thanks, Lee. Hey, real quick before you go, when you were doing that job, at least in the facilities that you worked at, was it common or uncommon for prisoners to have access to radio?
It was very common.
They
actually have catalogs that they can order stuff out of. Many of them have jobs, but they can order stuff out of these catalogs. And there's radios, at that time they could get CD players.
Nice.
Now
so you couldn't send a radio to a prisoner, right? That or could it come from Amazon? Would that be okay, or would you have to order it from the prison catalog so that they knew, you know, that didn't have contraband in it or something like that? How does that work?
A lot of them are actually clear. The cases were clear, so they could
see
through them.
Okay, right.
So at that time, they had to get their radios through the catalog.
Okay.
Now, I retired in 2016, so I know things have changed drastically since I worked there, but...
Mm. So would it be, I know this is probably going to sound like a dumb question because I'm assuming the answer would be an obvious yes, but would listening to the radio be something that the average prison inmate or jail inmate would be interested in doing, or would that not be high on the list?
Oh, yeah, that'd be, yeah. They would be interested in listening, definitely. Okay.
Well, I'd like to kind of springboard off what you're saying, Lee, and just encourage everyone listening wherever you are, especially if you're a deacon or a priest and you're involved in some way in prison ministry, let's see if we can't flood these prisons with radios, however they need to be obtained. Let's flood these prisons with radios so that these prisoners can know about Relevant Radio and listen to it.
Yes, definitely.
Would you work with the chaplain on that? Would that be the easiest way to do it?
Probably, yeah. If you could, most prisoners, you know, like you say, have a chaplain. You can contact the chaplain and ask them what you need to do to help get radios in there for people that don't have them, you know.
Yeah. That's really good. That's good to know, Lee. Well, this idea has been germinating in my mind for a long time now, and I've just been thinking if there would be some way to get a program going to help inmates get radio. Because I know what a life-changing thing it can be for them if they're if they have a lifeline
definitely.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, thanks,
yes,
Lee.
Definitely. Yeah, well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Well, also a shout-out to one inmate that I know. His name is Jeff Jimenez, and he listens every single day to Relevant Radio. I've never met Jeff. But he has written to me. I appreciate that, Jeff. So shout out to you. Hang in there, man. I realize that life behind bars, as you've described it, does not sound at all easy. So I'm glad to know that you have Relevant Radio to help you while you're there. God bless you. Let's go to Bob now in Fallbrook. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Patrick. Hey, my question is this. My wife and I are involved in like a Bible study class, neighborhood one, and we're the only two Catholics. And sometimes I get an impression that their opinion of Catholics are like second rated, I think, because of they think that we don't read the Bible and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this one time we were going over a passage that we read, and I told them what I wrote down. And then one of the ladies asked me, well, what Bible is that? And I told her, and it turned out to be, it was the Good News Bible. Mm-hmm. And I had gone to a retreat about 40 years ago when it was given to us. And so I started mm-hmm. reading that. And she said, oh, that's just a paraphrase Bible. And I had never heard that before. And I thought, well, gee, maybe I'm reading the wrong Bible. Mm-hmm. And so my my wife gave me another Bible that she had. It was called the New American Bible. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading that now. And I'm just wondering, I think you mentioned that you had wrote a book or something about the history of all the different Bibles and things like that. I'm just wondering if you could recommend.
Yeah, I didn't write.
If you could mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
No, I was just going to say,
I
didn't write such a book. I'm sorry, we're talking over each other by accident. Yeah, I'd be happy to recommend some books, but I didn't write the books that I'm going to recommend to you, Bob. So I have a feeling, does this sound right? Were you reading a paperback volume of the Bible called Good News for Modern Man? Is that the name of the version that you had before?
No, it was Good News Bible.
Okay.
In today's English.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's the same one that I'm thinking of, and maybe that was just an earlier name that was given to it, but Good News for Modern Man was one that I saw in the 70s, and that is, in fact, a paraphrase. So the term that's used there is paraphrastic, and that's just a way of describing that it's a paraphrase of Scripture. It's a way to try to put it into more colloquial modern English. And so it's not, I mean, it might be okay and helpful for devotions or just like personal reading, but it's not going to be as literal, and perhaps in some ways, because it's not literal, maybe not as accurate as a more literal translation. So that's why I personally never use paraphrastic Bibles for that reason. It's not that they're bad. They're just not that good. They're not that great. So maybe for somebody who has had no introduction to the Bible, that might be a starting point. But in any case, the books that I would recommend, I would start off with a book written by Henry Graham, and the book is called Where We Got the Bible, Our Debt to the Catholic Church. Now, what's interesting is that this is a book about how we actually got the Bible. How did these books get into the Bible? What was the process of what's called canonization, not about saints, but about, you know, how do we know which books belong in Scripture? What was that process? What about the manuscripts and the different families of manuscripts? The Codex Vaticanus, the Codex Sinaiticus, the various other codices, how do they interact and relate to each other? How do we know that what we have in the Bible is actually authentic? And how do we know it wasn't corrupted or changed at some point down the line? And there's a great deal of information. This book brings all that out. And it would be a really helpful book, I think, for you, Bob, especially given the fact that you're talking to many Protestants who are there, and they may be absolutely unfamiliar with these things. So Where We Got the Bible by Henry Graham. I would also recommend, if you're interested in kind of understanding how the Bible all ties together, Jeff Cavins has got the Great Adventure series of Bible studies, and that would be include the Bible timeline. So you can get a chronological, historical sense of how not only how the Bible developed over time, but also how these different books of the Old Testament and even the New Testament, how they relate to each other. So those are some suggestions. I think you'll find them helpful. And those are all easily available at your local Catholic bookstore. Start there. And if you don't have a local Catholic bookstore near you, you can always go online and find them there. Thanks, Bob. I'm going to be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
I like the exotic vibe, Cyrus. It's good for a Monday morning. 888-914-9... I was waiting to see if the woman was going to talk, but I guess not. 888-914-9149.
I was talking to you while she was talking. So she's already talked.
She spoke.
She spoke.
All right. FYI, the New York Post has an article this morning. Food prices are going to keep going up. They're saying there's no end in sight. That is outrageous. I filled up my car. I just drive a typical sedan. Nothing, you know, nothing huge or anything like that. And it cost me just shy of $90 to fill up the gas tank. It was pretty much on dead empty. I probably was down to maybe the last 30 miles of gas. And I filled it up yesterday and just shy of $90, Cyrus.
Yeah, yeah, I'm feeling the pain as well. Mm-hmm. It's, and mine is about $90 every time.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Kraft, Heinz, Tyson, Campbell Soup, they're all saying publicly they're going to raise their prices on products due to skyrocketing costs for labor, packaging, ingredients, transportation, according to the Wall Street Journal. McDonald's, Shake Shack, Cracker Barrel have also been saying that their prices are going up. Shake Shack CEO Randy Garuti, he says the inflation is real and it's not going to get any better anytime soon in the restaurant business. The Labor Department said Friday that grocery store prices had spiked 12%. Well, they said 11.9%, but let's round it because of inflation. So let's round it to 12%. And this over the last 2 years, those at restaurants and other food venues jumped 7.4%, marking the biggest increase in more than four decades. Kraft says it's raising its prices. Miracle Whip, Classico pasta sauce, Maxwell Coffee, deli meats, etc. Campbell Soup raising its prices. Tyson Foods, all that beef, all that chicken. It's the third largest. No, I take that back. Sanderson Farms is the third largest chicken producer. I believe Tyson might be the top. Their prices have gone up an average of 24% and 34% respectively. Hormel, makers of Spam. Not that kind of Spam, the other kind of Spam. They're saying that their livestock feed costs have gone up 125% since May. 125% since May. So if you're on a heavy Spam diet, Cyrus, you might want to rethink that and get some rice cakes or something like that.
You need to rethink that diet for all kinds of reasons.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So, hey,
but you know what?
You were just driving. So did you notice an increase in, I mean, I'm sure you had to stop somewhere to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Was it more expensive than usual?
I honestly don't remember.
No.
I didn't. You know, that's a good question. I wish I had an answer for you, but I didn't. We rolled through McDonald's to get a cup of coffee. I always get a senior coffee because it's like half the cost of a regular coffee.
Are you a senior?
I'm a senior. Yeah, yeah, right. I qualify, baby. So how about this? The average American household has had to spend an extra $460 a month just for food in the last couple of months, say within the last 6 months. On average, about an extra, roughly an extra $500 coming out of your budget.
Ouch.
Just for food. And that adds up. So it's an interesting article. It's not fun because we're all in it together and all of us have to pay the price for all these increases. Unlike anything I've ever seen. I was in California 2 weeks ago, and I saw it was like close to $8 a gallon for gasoline at a gas station.
Ouch.
So it's going up, up, up. So you'll be able to find that at the show Twitter feed, at P Madrid Show, or you can just simply go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Nobody wants to spend any more than we have to, but everything is going up.
And once it goes up, it never goes back down.
It seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, with food prices, especially.
I went into the post office last week to buy some stamps, and she said, oh, good, because the price is going up. You know, get your stamps now. Really? What? I think it's getting up to like nearly 50 cents a stamp. And when I was a tyke, when I was a tot, back in the early 60s, I could look it up, I suppose, but it seems to me like stamps were like 6 or 8 cents per stamp. So everything's going up. Let's go to Rick in Philadelphia. Hello, Rick.
Hey, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
Let me get off the speakerphone. I didn't want to be on it. I'm so sorry. You can hear me good?
Yeah, yeah. Go for it.
Okay, well, you know, I spent some time in federal prison, and I was there doing research for my book, you know, laughing out loud. But, but being a Catholic in there is not easy, because there is, as far as, this is federal prison now, as far as the Bureau of Prison goes, there's hardly any Catholic people coming in to teach anything. Most of the Bible studies are done by Protestants. most of the volunteers are Mennonites or fundamentalists. And, you know, it's something, but it's not what we crave. Now, there was a Catholic priest assigned to Fort Dix when I was in there, but I think he was a nice guy, and he was more interested in his golf game for me, but that's what I thought. I'm not talking bad out of him, but it wasn't what I would have thought a Catholic priest did, because he actually worked and got a salary from the Bureau of Prisons. So a lot of the older Catholic inmates wouldn't talk to him because they figured he was a cop. And that's their thinking. One way or the other, you can't be in between. Now I went up to Lewisburg, and it was a little different. There was a nice bishop up there that used to be in Philadelphia. I think his name was McLaughlin. And I wrote him a letter. He sent somebody there. But there was never really a Catholic presence. If you're Jewish or Muslim or Protestant, there's no other presence. And it's really hard. And as far as radios go, they sell radios in the commissary. And they're small, nothing like you've ever seen before. They get fit in your hand, and they're clear. So you could buy them in the commissary, but I would.
Yeah, that other guy that was called in earlier, he said the same thing. They're clear. And is that because they don't want heroin or something else inside there that would
any kind of
notice?
Contraband? Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's contraband. And guess what? Some of these guys in there, they could work for NASA if they were to want straight NASA. You know, I mean, they're really smart people, but they turn to that other side, and it happens. There's good people. But what I'm saying is you would probably have to deal with the Bureau of Prisons from Washington. Maybe somebody could lobby down there. Because they do send some books around once in a while to Catholics. But most of the stuff that I would get sent to me would be the Cardinal who was in Philadelphia, Cardinal Regali, Justin Regali. He was. I knew him, and he did send me some stuff. And my parish priest, Father Higgins. Yeah.
So would the typical prisoner, and let's say maybe the typical Catholic prisoner, and I think this is probably a dumb question, but I want to ask it anyway. Would the typical Catholic prisoner be interested in getting a radio if he knew or she knew that she could or he could listen to relevant radio?
Yes, okay. They would, because there's a lot of downtime, and you can only get in trouble on a downtime. Now, we used to sit out, like, on a Saturday night in the old baseball field, like in a dugout, and listen to different things. And at that time, there was a station in New Jersey that kind of got there. But you have to think, a lot of these radio signals, now yours is pretty clear, depending on where it's picking off. There's some prisons, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, that are all over, like in the middle of Minnesota. So they're all over. The big ones, like the detention centers, Manhattan, Philadelphia, all them places, they have, you know, they're in New York, so you get signals there. But there's always something. I've been out a while now, but the more that relevant radio gets bigger, the stronger the signals are, as you know. You know. So,
yeah, that's a very interesting thing. Now, the relevant radio app, Rick, I presume, is probably not something the prisoner could get, because if he had an app,
they could have
a phone, right? They couldn't get that, could they? Okay.
Yeah. Now, phones are a big deal. If you have a phone, you're going through the hole or the special housing unit. You can't have phones. You can't. I mean, it happens. People smuggle them in. You see some things there that are like, oh, man, incredible. You know, you couldn't even tell a story in a mixed group. But no phone, so the app wouldn't be good. There's a little bit of access to the Internet, but it goes through a site they have, and they approve everything. Like, I could send you something if you were accepted to be one of my friends.
And I knew a guy. He happened to be in my parish, and he went to prison for like 18 months for a white-collar crime, nothing violent or anything like that. And that was the first I found out about that, because he listed me as one of the contacts that could interact with him that way through this.
Now, if you went to visit him, it would be another list, right? Yeah, you have to be approved once they figure out. Now, priests and lawyers, and I think clergymen, you can get like special. You can put as many lawyers on your list as you can. I think also clergymen. You know, I had a priest from Philadelphia. I was in Fort Dix. Lewisburg was too far away. But like I said, Cardinal Regali came to see him, and he was a good man. He's retired now, living in Kentucky or something, enjoying it, I guess. But
so when you were in, Rick, was your situation pretty bleak in terms of access to Mass and the sacraments? Were there priests who came in to visit? Was it regular or was it periodic?
It was very periodic, especially at Fort Dix. At Lewisburg, we hardly saw anybody except when I wrote a letter to Bishop McFadden, because he was out of Harrisburg. He was in Philadelphia and went to Harrisburg. But
so you were stuck without much access to the sacraments, is that right?
Yeah, it was hard. And if they would have been, I mean, if I was in charge, I would have found one of the older Catholic inmates that was a Eucharistic minister. And let him, you know, we had our prayer services on Sunday But I would say you would see a priest once every 2 months, if we were lucky, once every month.
And wow. Oh, sorry.
Fort Dix. The chaplain of Fort Dix, he had a lot of people. We had two inside the fence, the camp outside. So, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you're out. I'm glad you're a free man. And thanks for the insight. This is not something that most of us ever really think much about, but we should, because Jesus said, when I was in prison, you visited me. That's a big thing. Matthew chapter 25. Thank you. Let's go to Anthony in Pahokee, Florida. I hope I'm saying the name right. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
I explained to your fellow man and answers the phone, Cyrus is his name.
Mm-hmm.
I explained that I was in prison, too, for 10 years. And everything that the two gentlemen heard this morning are absolutely correct. They're very strict when it comes to radios and paraphernalia and illegal things that come in. But you can, as the man said, there's a catalog that you can send to your elders. And I have a Sony that I'm listening to you right now on Relative Radio that I had from prison that was 10 years old now.
Wow.
It's a
wow.
Sony, and it was ordered from the catalog. So it is available through the prison ministry. And there is Catholic services once every Saturday. I receive from the deacon. I receive my communion and prayers and service. So there, it depends
That's
on
good.
The institution. You know, it depends on the institution, Patrick. And
good,
I'm certainly happy that I'm out and I can hear you at my place of residence now.
Me too. I've got to run, Anthony, but I'm so glad you're out. I hope and pray that you're a changed man. I can only imagine what you've been through. Thanks, Anthony. Great talking to you. I'm coming back with hour two right after this.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on.